everyone, Justin Chisholm here, welcoming you to the second exclusive member-only episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast Extra for April 2021. My guest this time is the renowned British yachtsman Neil MacDonald. Neil is perhaps best known for his ocean racing achievements in the Whitbread and Volvo Ocean Race, but he's also an Olympic campaigner and won world and European dinghy titles in his time, as well as spending 8 years campaigning on the Australian 18-foot skiff circuit. As well as 6 Whitbread and Volvo Ocean races as a sailor, including twice as a skipper, Neil coached Ian Walker's Abu Dhabi Ocean Racing team to victory in the 2014-15 edition, and he took on the same role with the Spanish Mapfre team in the 2017-18 race. Away from the fully crewed racing, Neil has put his technical analysis skills to good use as part of Alex Thompson's last two Hugo Boss Vendée Globe campaigns. Neil's a great character and he's always great to chat to, so this was a fun interview to be part of, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy it too. Well, Neil MacDonald, welcome to the Yacht Racing Podcast Extra. It's been a long time since we've spoken, and it's good to have you here. So tell us, first of all, where are you speaking to us from?
I'm speaking to you from home, which is in France, La Cierre, South France.
So south of France, and you've been there for quite a while now. Your whole family is kind of grown up there.
Yeah. No, I think I was looking to yesterday, actually, at some paperwork. I think I got here in 2003. So a long time.
And what drew you down to the south of France? I mean, that's a bit of a strange question to ask because there are obvious benefits.
It is. If you'd asked me 25 years ago, would I ever live in France, I'd have given you an emphatic no. But oddly enough, sailing brought me here. And I have never raced here. I've never worked here. But Lisa, when she did the Whitbread, I think it must have been the then Volvo 2000 race on Amer Sports. The Amer Sports boats were built here. So she made connections here. She spent some time here, liked the place, liked the feel of it. And that's what drew us here. We started off having a holiday home here. And very quickly, we ended up living here.
And am I right in thinking, I'm sure you told me this at some stage, that Lisa, a past Whitbread Volvo Ocean Race skipper in her own right, she also does some work with the lifeboat there?
Is absolutely. Oh, no, that's a big part of her life. No, very much so. She's deeply involved with that. And, you know, she's on call. When I'm here, at least she's on call all the time, yeah.
Is that a little bit of giving back to the sailing world?
It is. And, you know, I don't directly give anything other than when I am here, I'll look after the kids as easy way. But it's great to feel that there is something going back into the marine world. And, you know, my father is a sailor and he often says he's going to leave some money in his will to the lifeboats. And, you know, I really do think that worldwide that we owe a lot of favors to these guys.
So you talked about your father being a sailor. I wanted to start with talking, as I often do with people, about their earliest experiences of sailing, because sailing's been such a huge part of your life. So take us back. When was that first sailing experience? Who was it with? Where was it? What was it in?
With my father in a Mura dinghy, which he'd built for us. My father never raced, never intended to race, started sailing quite late, but was an avid cruiser. But before that, he did some dinghy sailing. So all my early sailing was just kicking about in boats, not racing at all. I didn't race a boat until I was about 12.
And whereabouts was this? Because I think you were born in Brighton, Neil, is that right?
Yes, I was born in Brighton. And funny enough, there's a puddle there called Pidding Hoe, which I believe the Greenhow boys used to sail on as well. But my brother now sails with his daughter on that puddle. It's a tiny little puddle just inside New Haven. Lovely place, great cadet group. And that's where I did my early sailing, mucking around.
And that first experience with your dad, what sort of age would Neil have been at that point?
4 or 5, I guess. Too young to really remember.
I was going to say, you can't remember it clearly, but it clearly wasn't a one-off. You must have continued.
No, continued just mucking around. Then he got into small, you know, 17 or 18-foot cruising boats, and I'd muck around on those. And then we moved to Wasash, and join the club there, but still not racing, just mucking around in boats again.
Now, Wasatch Sailing Club is a pretty legendary club, certainly in terms of British sailing clubs, a big dinghy club. Some great names have come out of there. Is that, can we credit any sort of credit to the sailing club for kind of leading
for sure,
you on?
For sure. I mean, when I started, there's a guy who I must have met, haven't even caught up with. It'd be interesting if you know where he is. Oh, his name's gone. Richard Hart, a Finn sailor. And he was like the professional there. And there really wasn't a great deal of other racing going on. But I remember watching him train. And I don't know whether I was interested in it to the extent that I thought I'd want to do it, or just thinking, what the hell, you know, what's driving this guy? But no, for sure, the sailing club there, when we did start racing, I started with my brother in Mirradingis. They had a great scene. I don't keep up with it. I'm not sure it's as active now, but we used to race on a Wednesday night, a Saturday and a Sunday, and fleets of 20 odd mirrors, relaxed but competitive, and, you know, just a great club, great fun.
You and your brother sailing together, it's familiar to me. I sail with my brother, my older brother, who obviously being older was the helmsman. What was the arrangement with you two?
It was all wrong because I was about 20 kilos heavier than him, but I did the driving. And I don't know why. I think that was because he was a multi-sports person. And for the first year or so when I was dabbling with racing and sailing, he would have been in the football team. I was incapable of doing any other sports, so I just focused on the sailing. And I guess it was natural when he took an interest that he did the crewing, and that would have made sense if I'd been 20 kilos lighter than him, but unfortunately I wasn't, which kind of molded my whole childhood. And I blame my greed at the moment on the fact that until I was probably 17, I was always on a diet, always living on a diet.
Who was the oldest between the two of you?
Me. Yeah.
Okay. By how long?
2 years. Yeah.
2 years.
2 years.
So Mirradingis was a big scene in the UK. Was this just a Wasatch, you know, local regattas, or did you get around?
Yes, it was very much. I mean, I just can't. I think my first proper, if you like, open meeting or championships would have been a national championships in a 420. So before that, all our sailing, I'd never raced the mirror in a national or an open meeting. It was local. At that time, and I still don't know now, but at that time, a lot of the clubs used to have inter-club championships. There's a club down the road, Hillhead and Western, all those places. So there would be sort of regattas that were inter-club regattas, but they weren't, you know, you're not putting the boat on a trailer and running off for the weekend and sailing against people you don't know. So I was very, 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 very late into that whole arena.
But were you bitten by the bug at this stage when you sail in the mirror?
Yeah. In fact, behind me in my shelves, I've got a logbook that I will photograph a page from Sandy. You shouldn't publish it, but you'll be amused. I was besotted by it, and it wasn't the racing. It was the mucking around in the boats. Obviously, the racing quickly took over, but that's not what got me into it at all.
And what sort of results were you getting at this stage? I mean, did you evolve into being super successful?
Yeah, I'd win the odd club cup. With my brother, we'd win the cadet week. Nothing you'd write home about or put on your website sort of thing if you were. But I think we found it reasonably easy to compete and enjoy it, which I think was, you know, lots of people were good and lots of people enjoyed it, but not many people were lucky enough to be able to kind of do both. So, we weren't club champions very often, but we'd win the odd race, especially if it was blowing 4,000 knots.
And did you do what my brother and I used to do, which was, you know, you'd race Saturday, Sunday, Wednesday nights, Friday nights, and when you weren't racing, you were talking about it. That's what
pretty
you can
much
do when you're brothers.
Yeah, yeah, pretty much. We'd be watching what each other had for breakfast later on and making sure we didn't have too many calories. Yeah, no, it was, and of course, much easier for parents to deal with dumping one set of kids and having two wetsuits in the bath, that, you know, it's not twice as much problem as one wetsuit hanging up in the bath. So for sure, that was a big part of it.
Now, let me just dive off a little here, because you have two kids, two wonderful kids, as I remember them. They're probably much bigger now than I remember them.
Yeah.
Have they developed your love of sailing, yours and Lisa's love of sailing?
No, interesting enough. And I'm very, very conscious not to push them into it. They both go horse riding, which is a sport I just hate the whole scene. But, you know, that's what they dream. They're both good sailboarders. Funny enough, they have done only two regattas in their life, and they both did unbelievably well in them. They didn't even know what port and starboard was, and a fleet of quite competitive toppers and optimists at Pidding Ho, fun enough, the place I first started. And they did surprisingly well and very much enjoyed it. But no, it hasn't really grown on them. They're obviously interested in it. They know enough about it. They could, you know, they put in a dinghy, they'd sail off, no problem, and do maneuvers. We did a little offshore to Sardinia a few years ago. They're sailors, but they're not bitten by the bug at all. And I'm conscious of not wanting to force them to do it. If they're interested, I will certainly push hard to help them, but not unless that's something they really want to do.
Well, I'm proud of you for not pushing them, but I must confess I'm slightly disappointed that there's not a new generation of McDonald's coming through to entertain.
You never know. I didn't start. They're still – one of my interesting things is I ended up – and maybe jumping the gun a bit, but I ended up in the youth squad with a lot of people who were started young in optimists and were far better, you know, competitive sailors than me. But I suspect – that I've gone on to enjoy the fruits of my sport more than they have. And I don't feel that there's that necessity to be trying to paddle your way across the start line and not get caught in an optimist at the age of five. That's something I obviously, if you want to be an Olympic gold medalist, that's what you need to be doing. But I don't feel that's necessary if you want to make a living or enjoy this sport. So, you know, I there's time for them. They're not going to win Olympic golds. I know that. And that doesn't worry me. But yeah, it's interesting. My colleagues or people I were training with, you know, I think had different backgrounds, and I'm not sure they got any more out of the sport than I have.
Yeah. I think that's a good point, because when you look at your career, you know, as a whole, as I've done just for research for this conversation, I mean, you've touched on all of the key areas. You've been involved in all of the key areas: the Olympics, the America's Cup, Volvo Ocean Race, and you know, now the Vendée stuff that you've worked on. We'll come on to all of that. But let's go back to, I guess, still a teenager. How did you progress from Mirrors? Was there a progression, or did you stay in Mirrors?
Yes, there was definitely. My parents realized that we wanted to, you know, jump up a class. And unbelievable. I mean, there was no science to it. And I often talk to them about it, you know, what drove them. We went into a 420, and I don't know why my father thought that was a good idea, but he did. He had no idea that there was a youth squad, it would lead to other areas of sailing. But for sure, that was just a stroke of luck. And so we bought a second-hand 420 and just carried on club sailing, but slowly getting better and a bit more interested in it, and suddenly realizing that we'd have to do a bit of gym time and bits and bobs like that. So that's really where the racing started getting a bit more serious. And we might have done a couple of open meetings in that. Surprised ourselves when it was windy by kind of doing well, and disappointed ourselves very, very resoundingly when it was light, which it could be a story of my dinghy sailing career. But that then led indirectly to a connection with Jim Saltonstall and their youth squad, and that just changed everything. And then it really did become totally, probably as much for my brother as me, but certainly absolutely totally everything in my whole life was centered around sailing at the age of maybe 14 or 15 to the age of 18. Yeah.
Now, for those British listeners to the podcast will know, very likely know who Jim Saltonstall is. He's a legend in our sport. But Neil, can you, for the non-Brits and people who might not know Jim, can you kind of sum up his role in everything, and just who he was and what sort of character he was?
Well, he was working for the RAA for all the time I knew him, and was the youth training coach, the head youth training coach, and had a remarkable way of getting the best in people. He made the training fun. He made it exciting. He had very simple rules. He didn't complicate the issues. And my brother, for one, knows every word of his lectures. He did about 6 years of them. He knows every single word, and they don't change from year to year. There's not a great deal of science or complex nature to him. He just knows, points people in the right direction, knows what's generally best, and has a great way of teaching. He was a wonderful, wonderful guy. Tremendous.
He was. And I think he kind of went way beyond the brief of his role, didn't he? Because he put his heart and soul, his whole life into...
Well, I mean, I'm sure he won't mind me saying, but I used to go running before school with him. You know, it was like he didn't have to do that. You know, 7:30 on a school day, I'd be knocking on his door to go for a run with him. He lived very close to us. And that's, you know, that is well beyond the call of duty. I'm not sure how you'd like it if some snotty-nosed kid was knocking on your door at 7:30 in the morning. I mean, that's just an, you know, it gives you a clue of what he did for us and many, many, many more. Yeah.
The other thing that I remember so much about Jim when he was active in the youth stuff was just his voice. Like, he had a voice that didn't require a microphone.
I won't even bore you with it. I can say every sentence as you knew and I knew. He's the only guy who speaks like this. You know what I mean?
That's it. Yeah. It's a wonderful northern accent and required no microphone. And he had a habit of calling the sailors ferrets.
Yeah, young ferrets. Yeah, get out in the wire. You know, ferrets, you can do that.
I remember he first said to me something about. He said some of the fast ferrets I found, when he first said it, I was like, "What is this guy talking about? Like, there's something wrong with him." But then you watch him.
Oh.
You watch him with an Amazing. Audience of kids, just absolutely captivated. Huge part of. Of British sailing, and obviously a big influence on yourself. So what did that lead to, Neil?
Well, not very much in the end. You know, I did a great deal of time with him. I thoroughly enjoyed it. But in terms of results, my brother and I had a chance of going to the Youth Worlds, I guess. I can't even remember what year it was. But in fact, the trials were in Largs and ended up being a washout for us, light wins. And in fact, I do remember Kevin Sproul went instead. And it was a far better choice. My physique was wrong for the 420. You know, I was 6 foot or whatever, and driving one of those was wrong. But also, I looking back, I was much more interested in the boat handling and keeping fit and sailing in 4,000 knots rather than actually thinking about which end of the start line to and how to get across the start. You know, I probably didn't do the amount of interest and energy that Jim put into me justice, to be honest, at the time. I had a you know, streak of results which were reasonably good on paper, but if you looked at the average wind speed of when we did well, it was normally very high, not so good in the lighter stuff.
So tell me a bit about Duncan then. What was he like personality wise? I've never met him.
Oh, I think you'd enjoy him. I mean, he's a much more competitive guy than I am and has done much more competitive sailing than me, funny enough. You know, he won the J111 Worlds a few years ago. He's very, very interested in sailing. He stayed on the youth squad for 2 more years than me just because he's younger. Ended up sailing with a lot of different people, sailing with Paul Brotherton for a while. When Paul was first doing it, he was very interested, but an all round better sportsman than me. You know, I really didn't do any other sports, and he was torn at early age whether we keep continuous football or go sailing.
Together, you had some pretty impressive results in classes like the 14s, and I think in the 49ers as well. So join the dots for me on this. How did we get from...
There's a bit of a gap if you looked at any of my sailing history. Once the youth squad thing all faded out because, first of all, I was getting far too big, and secondly, I was too old, I joined the Navy and basically stopped competitive sailing for 4 or 5 years. And looking back on it, I'm not quite sure why. Just geographically difficult. And then I sort of slithered back into it. It's quite strange. A name you might have not heard of, Nigel Buckley. One summer, my brother crewed for him in a fireball and a Nationals. And then I can't remember how they did. And then his 505 crew dropped out a few weeks later and rung me up. And I hadn't done any sailing for a long time. So I'll do that. And went to the 505 Nationals and we won it rather remarkably, particularly as I remember our first day result was 122nd. So I wasn't confident that we were going to do well.
Wow.
And as you know, 50s then were an unbelievable class. So probably still are, you know, 60 or 70 boats. Well, no, 122, obviously. Mm. Big fleets. And that kind of got my interest back in it. And then I went straight into International 14s because my brother had been sailing with James Hartley. And suddenly I saw a boat where it was okay to be heavier than the crew because you're both on the trapeze. And so that became another focus for probably 3 or 4 years of my life, just 14, 14, 14s and 14s.
And the 14s then, were twin trapeze at that point?
True trapeze. The day they got true trapezes, I bought the first boat, basically. I went through the era of two trapezes, then the asymmetric, and missed out on the foiling four stuff, obviously. But, yes, it was an exciting time to be involved in that class.
They were pretty brutal boats to sail, weren't they? I mean, they were kind of like the 18-foot
physical
skiffs.
Physical boats and, you know, very, very rewarding, but equally they were punishing if you didn't have the right equipment. They were, unfortunately, and I'd say it now, they were, you know, a rich boy's class, which I didn't particularly like that aspect of it, but, you know, I bought into it. And in fact, at that stage, I was earning, and, you know, I spent every single penny on it for the best part of five or 6 years. Yeah, I wouldn't have been able to do anything else.
Culminating in a world championship win in 1989. Yep. Tell us about that. Right. Where was that?
San Francisco. And, you know, we'd gone headlong. History is a bit odd because in between starting the 14 and winning that world championships, there was that Olympics that I managed to jag a spot in. But the long and the short of it was that the 14 was our goal. We focused on it very, very hard. Bought a reasonable secondhand boat first, and then went through the process of looking at what was happening and focused our event and said, right, well, San Francisco is going to be windy. That's going to be it. My brother was at medical school, and this is where my connection, I guess, with my godson's father, Damon, came strongest. He knew Ian Howlett, the boat designer, and had a long-standing relationship with him. I think he might have even gone to university with him. So Damon and I basically built these boats, two boats, together in a cow shed in Hedge End. We had a lot of help. We kind of hand-built the molds. Somebody else laid up the skins, but we finished it all, basically built from scratch. I'd taken a massive dive and bought a boat while we were building this. So basically I had two boats, shipped one off to San Fran, was sailing the other one. So taking it pretty seriously, I'd sort of managed to do this around work at the time. And then we went out to San Francisco and said, right, we're going to do this, do it properly. Did 3 months and basically sailed every day for a month in the windy part of San Francisco. And our goal every day was, right, whatever the wind, we're going out. We'll try and do one tack, one spinnaker hoist, if that's our minimum. And some days that's all we did.
Wow.
Because it was pretty windy and the boats still were quite unmanageable, particularly in the bay there. And by the time the championships came, the wind had died a little, but still windy enough. And, you know, we kicked butt. And it kind of all came together. We had the right boat. It was the right conditions. And we'd focused pretty heavily on it.
So you turned up in San Francisco for this. Did people know who you were? Did anybody expect you to win?
I don't know. I mean, we'd had I think a third or second, I can't remember now, in the 14 worlds before that. So we had been dabbling in the 14s for a while and, you know, getting a modicum of good results. And I think at that stage we might have won a Prince of Wales week and a Nationals or something. Yeah, so we'd been focusing hard at it and picking off some results on the way. And really neither of us were doing any other sailing. So that year was kind of our year, and you know, we went out there, as I say, 3 months. We did the American Nationals and won those, but took it like a championships that only single people who have got some money behind them could. And I spent everything I own, you know, so, and had nothing left at the end of it, absolutely nothing.
But good result though.
A good result and a great experience. You know, I wouldn't have changed it for anything. To sell the boat that we basically, well, my brother didn't do a thing, of course, but that's built ourselves, was rewarding as well. You know, every single fitting I basically hand cast or screwed on, or you know, I learned a great deal from that. At that stage, I got 2 degrees in naval architecture, but actually being able to do hands-on stuff rather than sit there with equations probably did me a great deal of good. I don't do a lot of that now, but I'm sure it helps me understand people who are doing that.
But you are a technical guy. I mean, my experience of you working with you on a couple of ocean race campaigns, you are a technical guy.
I become more and more. I mean, I'm almost addicted to finite element work at the moment. And the more spare time I get, the more I've done that. So no, I do suddenly find myself falling back on 6 years of university, basically. Yeah. Although for the first 20 years of my life, I probably never used a thing of it.
You're addicted to what, Neil?
Finite element analysis, which sounds ridiculous, but yes, modeling mass and structures. Yes, I waste a lot of time on that at the moment. And yeah, it's interesting how you can model a lot of things in real life in the sailing world and get a better understanding of them.
We'll come on to a bit of that, I'm sure, in a second. I want to flick back to that Olympic campaign.
Yes.
You said you jagged it. It was a Flying Dutchman campaign with Roger Yeoman,
who yes,
is a name I remember from those days very much. I didn't realize you'd sail with Roger. Tell us about it. You were out in Korea, I think.
It's a very, very strange story. I'd known Roger for a while through the 14s. I must admit, I haven't kept in touch with him. I'd love to. Very entertaining, clever guy, good sailor. We'd been sailing 14s together. He was a very successful business guy. And our paths didn't cross a great deal other than drinking beer and, you know, laughing at each other on the water in the 14s. And then suddenly one day out of the blue, he rung out when I was working in Gosport in the towing tanks, actually, for the Navy. He rung up and said, look, I've just lost my crew. How do you fancy an Olympic campaign? And I thought, I'd never been in a Flying Dutchman. I can remember exactly how heavy I was at the time. I was 82 kilos, too light, too short. Didn't really know Roger. And of course, I was in a full-time job. So it didn't all look great. But within about 12 hours, I'd said, you're right, I'm off.
Sort yourself into it.
Yes. And I don't think I should go into too much detail work-wise because that might cause some problems down the road. But long short of it, it's my immediate line manager thought that if I took unpaid leave, the civil service and the Navy were involved in my pay situation would have been fine. So I just shot off, just left. Packed up and went.
Because you could contrast that with people like Rodney Patterson, who I think kind of got sanctioned leave from the forces to do some of these campaigns.
Yeah, it's an odd branch of the Navy I was in, and there were some odd, looking at it, it would have been pretty strange just to up sticks and go. And then basically we spent 3 or 4 months in Europe doing every single regatta there was, and in between training out of Itchener Sailing Club in hailing into just a harbour. And, you know, again, he was very driven, very clever. He'd made a commitment to do no work for that whole year. We were both at a stage where, you know, we could combine our pool, our thoughts. It was the first crewing I'd really done other than the 5-0. So it was a different game for me. So a little bit of a learning process for me. And, you know, we got on like a house on fire. I don't know if you know Roger. He's unbelievably entertaining and very, very driven. I can see why he did well at business. He was very, very, very focused on what we did. And we were lucky in some respects, but also, you know, he'd put in all the hard miles. He'd done several years in the FD before me. And so I came in with no FD experience at all, no Olympic experience whatsoever. And that was probably, you know, a drawback to begin with, but perhaps brought a few new ideas. And between us, you know, we spent a lot of time driving around Europe and we'd basically shoot the breeze. And between us, we worked well and came up with some great plans. And did well. And in the end, pretty easy win with Olympic week. We were worried about two people. Funny enough, one of them was Rodney, and John Turner was the other guy at the time, who was, you know, a full-time sailor and built his own boats, who I'd come across in other classes. And in the end, it was a reasonably easy win, and went on to have a great Olympic experience. Not didn't come back with any gongs, but, you know, had a great time.
Yeah, I mean, sixth overall in that class, and that was the class at the time, wasn't it? That was the technical boat.
Yeah, there were some great people. You know, I remember the names there, Murray Jones. You know, the names were endless. We had a great, great time. The only disappointment in retrospect is we didn't think once we qualified we could do as well training with English crew as foreign crew, because obviously once you put all your heart and soul and your goal was the trials, and once you finish the trials to actually get funding and carry on was pretty hard. So we teamed up with the Canadian guys and spent 2 more months with them in Europe training, and I think they only beat us in 1 out of 15 regattas or something, and they went on to get gold. They got bronze. And we got six. And at the time, I was disappointed. But I look at it now, you know, that was Frankie's second Olympics. And I think the whole Olympic thing, I know I don't suffer from nerves, but I didn't perform well the first 2 or 3 days. And I think Roger might have been the same. And in the end, you know, we had a great regatta. And if we judged it on our last 2/3 of the regatta, you know, we'd have been in a medal slot, but we messed up the first few days.
It's interesting you say that. One of the things I noted from the podcast interview I did with Ray Davis recently was that when I asked him what his role was while the racing was going on, he said, well, you know, you give him feedback afterwards. And he said, but it's really important from my point of view that we just try to make every day just like another day on the water. Even though you know, it's the America's Cup and it's, you know, it's not just another day on the water. So I guess that kind of plays back into what you're saying.
Oh, for sure. And the Olympics is a different game. And, you know, when my brief little, in fact, the 49er Europeans I won with Paul Brotherton, you know, it's the same thing. When you get to the gold fleet in those boats, it's a different fleet. Suddenly you're racing against everybody who's good. There's no duffers. You can't assume anybody's going to give you an inch. You can't assume anybody's going to make a mistake any more than you do. And it is just a different game. And the first 2 days, I think the first day, it made me cry. You know, we were on the start line with a jib that didn't unfurl. And we must have done 400 starts, proper starts in Olympic fleets before that. And it never happened before. Just you know, ridiculous. Wow. Just bad way of dealing with it. And of course, that put you in a bad stare the next day. We didn't do so well. And once we got that out of our way, we did great. I would say to anybody doing those sort of events that it's very important. The head game is much bigger than I would have given it any time, any emphasis. You know, I would not have seen the need to get that part of it right. But looking at it now, you know, the number of people who don't do well in their first Olympics is amazing.
I don't want to move on without just asking you about the Flying Dutchman. When I was growing up, that was the boat I had pinned on my wall. Pictures of Flying Dutchman. What were they like to sail?
They're wonderful. I mean, I quite like to go back and have a go in one. Kind of clumping, heavy. You know, they'd still plane at wind, which is like always a feeling that I had, that, you know, to get a dinghy going around the course and enjoy it, you needed to plane at wind. They did. They were brutal in terms of the pumping rule back then. I think in Korea we had big waves. We were offshore in big waves. And I was in reasonable shape then, very, very unusual for me, but in good shape. And you couldn't pump enough physically. But that was, once you were planing, that was fine. You know, you were literally pumping down every run all the way. So very, very physical boats. Interesting with the continuous trapeze system, which, funny enough, you know, I don't see in any other boat now. So I don't know. Maybe the Contender might have it. I can't remember. Obviously not that great a deal. Otherwise, other boats would have had it. Difficult, but you needed that for the second handful of the jib. The big overlapping Genoa meant that you needed to do two hands during the tack. So you basically were stuck with that. So, good, great boat, and you know, good fun thing to start playing with the rake and all that sort of thing. Great, great boat.
Just touch back on that continuous trapeze. So you didn't use a handle when you went out on the wire. Is that what you're saying?
You still used a handle, but basically you wouldn't hook on. You'd have one. Okay. You'd have one hand on the jib sheet, one hand on the handle, and at the last handful you took in on the jib sheet, would you go out with? You'd hold on to the handle, and the elastic would let the pulley run onto the hook.
Right.
So you still went out on the handle, but you didn't actually have to physically hook on because you were still holding that last meter of jib sheet you're pulling in.
That's impressive. That's impressive. And I mean, the FD crews were big guys then. What would you have been weighing at that point?
I went from 81 kilos to 93 or something in just a couple of months. You know, I'd spent my whole life dieting, so it wasn't as easy as I thought, actually, because I couldn't eat enough. But I spent a lot of time in the gym, and but I was still undernourished. For, you know, most of the guys were taller than me. Most of the guys were bigger. But we didn't do too bad in the breezy start. I think our best races, I think we got a second in one race, a breezy race in Busan, where it was unbelievable. I mean, difficult to describe to people now when you think of Olympic regattas, but basically we'd sail for an hour, and those boats did 15 knots pretty easy. We'd sail for an hour to get the race course. You wouldn't see the land. God knows why we're out there. We're out there in rolling waves, 3 meter waves, where you couldn't see the land. It was phenomenal sailing, but strange.
You wonder how they managed to anchor the marks.
Oh, the big problems. Big problems. Yes. Mm.
So how did this translate into your offshore career? So at this stage, you're still in the Navy. You go back from the Olympics, you're still in the Navy. What happened?
Yes. There? I probably won't get in trouble. I had a meeting with the guys, and they said, "Oh, we're so pleased we supported you." And in fact, they'd actually fired me before the Olympics. But once we'd qualified, they were very pleased. So I'd had a meeting with the guy, and he said, "You've got this out of your system now, haven't you? Well done." And I have to say, I told a white lie. I said, "Oh, yes, I'm not going to do any more of this." And then a year later, I walked out the office one day and said, "I'll see you later." Emptied my personal belongings into a cardboard box and walked out, and that was it. And that's when I went to San Francisco. So that was the end of that. And then, as my mother would say, I've never done a proper day's work since.
Quite right too.
Yeah.
And where did the first Whitbread was 93-94 with another big name in British sailing, Laurie Smith.
Yes. The funny thing about that, and not many people would know this, but while I was in my class, while I was in the 14s, preparing for the 14s, I did have a potential opportunity to go on Rothmans. And it was a massive, massive issue for me. Do I carry on with my 14s? And I don't quite remember how it came about and whether it was a real opportunity or not. But I did have this toss-up. Is, do I go for this and bin the 14 that I'd been focusing on for years? And at that stage, I'll promise you, I didn't know which way a winch turned. I'd never been on a keelboat. So I wouldn't have had a lot of respect for keelboat sailors. So I'd already made that call, which I still look back on and probably did the right thing. But I don't know. So didn't do the Rothmans one, which I believe was that 87.
I guess it must have been, yeah.
89. I can't remember now. You'd be able to find 89 it might have been, because that was the Olympics were 88. Yes, so I'd missed that opportunity. Hadn't done any keelboat sailing at all at this stage. At all. I'd not even been on one. And I think the 14 worlds, that led to the 18-foot skiffs. Yeah, that was my next big gig, was straight from the 14s to put my heart and soul into 18-foot skiffs in Australia. And I basically spent 8 years doing that.
Wow. I did not know that. So this is your own campaign in the skiffs?
No, I basically bumped into a few Australians in San Francisco, said, look, let me know if there's anything coming up, and teamed up with a team in Australia and went straight out there. And basically never, for the next 8 years, never missed a skiff season. You know, on September, whatever it was, the first I'd be on a plane to Australia to get straight back onto a skiff.
You're making a decent living from these campaigns?
No, I mean living. I'd go with $200 in my pocket and come back with $200 in my pocket. And towards the end of the season, when the skiff sailing sort of thinned out, I'd work on building sites or whatever. But no, I wouldn't. I could have just about done the year without doing any work, but no, just making ends meet.
So tell us about those skiffs, because that was a legendary. I mean, the skiffs are still around now, but in their day, they were kind of the golden fleet, weren't they, that everybody aspired to?
Wonderful. I mean, just terrific. And, you know, when I first started, they went for a stage where there were unlimited wings, and then there were 20 foot. I think they're now 14, if I remember rightly. When I did it, they're 18, first year, 18 foot wide, 18 foot long. They were just unbelievable boats. I lived for them, and sailing in Sydney Harbour for that period of time was just a dream come true. And if, fun enough, you know, I look back to all the 14-foot skiffs, or the international 14-foot skiff sailing training that my brother and I used to do in Chichester Harbour, dodging all the flying 15s and all the other boats. It was a wonderful training ground. You know, it was just scaling it up a little bit, and the next thing you were doing is an 18-foot skiff charging around, dodging sabots in Sydney Harbour.
It's the Manly Ferry.
Like a natural progression.
Yeah. Dodging the ferry too, right?
Well, no, I have the not always. I've two boats have sailed into a ferry at full speed, and I happen to be on one of them.
Oh no!
The first time I saw it was the spinnaker, the bow of the ferry coming through the spinnaker at about 18 to 20 knots.
Wow!
Yeah. So I think two boats have done it, and I was one of them. Yeah, I did most things in skiffs, and that was definitely one of them.
Well, I was just about to say that what other people have told me about the skiffs is that it's the kind of boat that you don't really have a proper job, because you come back with broken knuckles and fingers and noses and
no, it's pretty brutal. I mean, I had a some great skiff stories. I won't bore you with all of them, but some unbelievably odd wounds, and one of them was a massive cartwheel. And in those days, you buy a nice wetsuit, your team wetsuit, and the first thing you do would be get a knife and chop the top off. It would just basically be a pair of long trousers. So too hot. And I don't know if they rules now, but we never wore life jackets. They were deemed pretty unsafe. So you just have a pair of these trousers on. And I did a massive cartwheel in the harbour one day, and we all went swinging around the front, as you could imagine. And if you work it out, the height of the mast, this is the big rig, there's a long sweep. And the elastic wasn't quite long enough to do its job. It broke. And as I was going around the front, thinking, oh, I think we're going to be lucky. I think we're all land in the water. Nobody's going to get hurt. I heard this strange noise. And what's that? The elastic broke, my elastic, right at the back of the boat when I was right in the front, and came at me, 1,000 miles an hour, and got me right in the nipple. And absolute agony. I had a bruise the size of a dinner plate on my nipple. So there's a number of injuries I've had from those boats, which I'm unlikely to receive again, I have to say. But yes, yeah, I had a great, basically 8 years, I think I did it.
We can only hope you don't get that again. I'm just thinking about writing the show notes for this podcast as we go through the interview. That one has to go in, I think. That's going to lure a few people in.
Very sore, very sore.
So tell me, this Whitbread 93-94, how did, when did the phone ring on that one?
I'm actually a little confused about timing. So basically, the skiff sailing was my dream after the 14. Went over there. And of course, I had to fill my winters up. And that's when I started keelboat sailing. And I think I must have done an Admiral's Cup with Laurie. Again, I had some odd stories about that. Certainly, most of the people on the boat would have thought, who on earth is this idiot? I think at the first weather mark or something, Laurie was steering and I was mainly doing tactics and I mean, basically didn't know anything. Certainly less than I do now. And he said, well, which spinnaker? I said, well, what do you mean, which spinnaker? Just get the spinnaker up. I had no idea you have more than one spinnaker.
Right.
This isn't a one tonner. Of course, we had three or four. All I knew is we needed a bigger sail and let's get the spinnaker up.
Busted.
Yes. That wasn't a great start to it. But yeah, so I kind of obviously got involved with Laurie at that stage. I must have connected with him because he was at the same Olympics. So we got a bit of a drinking rapport going there. And then it must have been led one thing to another. So just a couple of Admiral's Cups, and then there was the Fortuna project, which I kind of thought, here we go, this looks great fun. Got involved in that.
Yeah, bit of a damp squib in the end. And I can't believe I'm...
Well, there's very few people I can think of, well, all the people on that boat, but... still to this day, still sailing. There's not many people who've managed to break 2 miles in one race, but yes, I'm in that team.
Yeah. And was it 2 miles in 24 hours?
No, that would be exaggeration. The first one was certainly within 24 hours. The next one was probably a week later in the Biscay on the way back.
Oh, okay. Good. Wikipedia needs to get updated then, because it does say 2 broken masts in 24 hours, which I put three question marks after. So is it true that when the mast came down the second time, Laurie was in his bunk and said, well, I know what that bloody noise was?
I don't know. I was on deck. I could believe that. No, I was on deck. And actually, the second mast was on the verge of being pretty dangerous. It was in the Biscay and plenty of breeze, and we had to hack it off. And I remember Jason and I were down to one hacksaw blade when we were cutting the last shroud. And certainly at that stage, we were considering that the mast was going to go through the boat. And when the boat came out, it had started that process. So, yeah, we were desperate to get rid of it. And down to one hacksaw blade, I think we'd taken about 20.
Wow.
Cutting through the Nitronic 50, yeah. So, no, that was pretty unpleasant, the last rig coming down. The other one was... disappointed to say the least, but it wasn't a life or death. But the second one was a memory I wouldn't like to repeat.
So that race ultimately ended up in a retirement. I wanted to ask you though about sailing with Laurie, because again, for British listeners, they'll all likely know who Laurie Smith was and still is a great yachtsman and a big name. I mean, I think it's fair to say before Ben Ainslie came along, Laurie was the best known name in British sailing, probably, along with maybe Rodney Patterson and people like that. But he was quite a character, wasn't he? He was very much larger than life.
Yeah, no, incredible character. And again, I think it'd be difficult to describe anybody more competitive. You know, if you're eating a sandwich, there would be something competitive about it for him. He was quite an incredible character. And also, I don't think everybody would realize that the range of sailing he'd done. You know, he'd been to the Olympics in a sailing. He'd done some match racing because that was part of the medal racing there. The dinghy sailing, offshore sailing, inshore sailing. Quite incredible the range of sailing he'd done. And funny enough, we'd sailed a skiff together. I'd come back and sailed an 18-foot skiff with him for a while. And none of those disciplines were difficult for him to master and be the best at. You know, he very, very, very talented sailor, but competitive guy.
we were talking a little for a few minutes before we started the podcast, and we mentioned that back in those days, there seems to have been more big characters around than perhaps we see these days. It might be rose-tinted glasses for us, but if you look back at Laurie, I mean, the one thing that everybody will remember about Laurie was his golden locks. You know, he looked more like a rock star, a glam rock star, than he did a yachtsman. And to be fair, Neil, I seem to remember that your hair was pretty similar back then.
Yeah, I've heard a few people say he's the Keith Richards of the sailing world. I think a lot of it was there were less rules then. There was more gung-ho approach to life. You were less required to look the part, say the right things. You could be outspoken and not find that your sponsorship was cancelled a week later. I think a lot of it is that. But, yeah, he was and still is an amazing character. And it's not long ago he ran the Dragon Worlds. You know, I think it's incredible the diversity of the sailing he's managed to do. And when he takes something on, he takes it on.
Do you still speak to him?
I haven't spoken to him for a long time. I'd very much like to. You know, he was a massive part of my offshore sailing, and I still say that he is the best skipper I've ever sailed with.
You sailed with him again in 97-98 with Silk Cut, another cigarette manufacturer. Just gives us an indication that boats are being sponsored by tobacco companies still at this point.
Yes.
That was the Whitbread Round the World race. As I remember it, Silk Cut was a Whitbread 60, but correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Again, those boats were just fearsome, weren't they? What was that experience like?
Yeah, wonderful, and it couldn't have done with a better guy. I mean, I think that race, I think we went in feeling we had a shot at it, and, you know, we did. We didn't come away smelling of roses. We broke a mast in the Southern Ocean, which obviously puts you back up points-wise. But, you know, even without that, I think we'd have struggled to win easily for sure. Whereas I think at the start, I hoped and felt we had a good chance of winning easily. But what we did get was we always got the 24-hour records every leg. Funny enough, that boat was one of the series of far boats. And if I remember rightly, Laurie did say, well, I want this boat to be good in light winds. I think light winds are going to be important in this race. Everybody's going to go quick in the strong winds. I want the boat that's good in the light winds. And we went on to win every leg 24-hour and the world record at the time, which stood for a long time. So I don't quite know what went wrong there. But breaking the mast wasn't great. But we also, we just didn't quite get off to the right, on the right foot. And it wasn't our race. It wasn't to be our race. But my God, I enjoyed it. It was just, we had a great team, some great people to sail with. And it was the first time it felt like you could really send boats and push them basically to the absolute limit till they're underwater. And it was not quite who dared win, but who could push them hardest, sensibly, for longest. And Laurie was an absolute master at that. He was a wonderful guy to sail with. And to this day, nobody will believe me, but he didn't go on deck when it was windy. And yet he knew he was the best steerer. But he managed to control the situation and have people keeping that boat pushed without even going on deck. And there's very few people who have that technology, ability and leadership qualities that difficult to put my finger on it, but nobody would. Well, if you told them that, they'd obviously believe you, but then you tell them that actually he was a better steerer than all of us as well, they'd say, well, those two things don't add up. But it was that's how it was.
So why do you think he did that?
He's such a competitive guy. He only did it because it was going to be better for the end result. And, you know, in those situations where it was touch and go, perhaps he felt it was better to be monitoring what was happening than actually physically involved puffing and panting on the wheel for 2 or 3 hours. I don't know why, but whatever he did it right, because, you know, that boat was undoubtedly the fastest boat in that race and for a long, long time held the 24-hour record. Very odd thing looking back on it.
So by this stage, did you now consider yourself a round the world racer? If people asked you,
no, not really at all. I mean, I did, basically, it was the second or third time I'd been in a keelboat. You know, I really still done very little keelboat sailing at that stage. And although very quickly, when you're on a boat that's racing around the world at that level, you know, suddenly you feel natural in a keelboat. It still felt my roots would have been dinghy sailing. And I think I still went back and did skiff sailing after that. And I think I got back off that race and went and did an Olympic campaign, you know, immediately off the back of that race in the 49er. So, yes, I still thought that dinghies were me, and that was 97, which, you know, I'd have been whatever I was, 35. Not a youngster by any means.
And that Olympic campaign was with who?
With Paul Brotherton.
With Paul Brotherton. Okay. Mm. Okay. And you went to the Olympics?
No. what did we do? We won a Europeans. We got a pretty easy sixth in the Worlds that year. And then, yeah, just the time commitment. I was juggling too many things. Trying to do other campaigns, trying to do keelboat stuff as well. Suddenly at that stage, I thought, well, actually, there's a potential I could earn a living out of this sport. So, yes. Just took too much on, and in the end, I didn't feel I was probably the best person that Paul should have on the boat. So, yeah, just kind of let that slide away. And in the end, Paul didn't qualify. I thought he should have. Ian Barker did and went on to get – did he get a gold or silver?
Got silver. Silver, I think, yeah,
yes.
Silver.
Yes, yeah.
Interesting. So you really were mixing it. You were mixing it across all sorts of disciplines at this stage.
Well, yes, I think we haven't talked about it, but I think I was doing it at the time too with another sailor that should be mentioned in your list of greats, English greats, was I was sailing Chris Law a lot, doing a lot of match racing. I did a lot of world-class match racing events.
Right.
A lot
so
of
you were on
them,
the World Match Race Tour circuit at that point?
Yeah, 2 or 3 years. Yeah.
He was another huge name, as you say, and quite a complex character. What was he like to sail with?
Again, very different from the other people I sailed with. Good entertainment. I mean, he was an entertaining, clever guy. You know, a little known fact was I think he was Olivetti's salesman of the year worldwide while he was actually had a job. He was a clever, clever guy. Good at manipulating people and getting the best out of a team. Match racing with him was entertaining, and you never knew what he's going to do next. You know, if he jumped over the side of the boat, I wouldn't be surprised, or you know, or swore at the umpires, which is another great favorite of his. But a very, very talented sailor and great in that arena. Very, very good fun to sail with. And again, for me, not being a keelboat sailor at that stage, I'd have said I wasn't. It was a great way to learn quickly about boats. In a completely different part of the sport to what I'd spent any time in as a youngster.
So let's just step away from the sailing a little bit. I want to ask you about when you met your now wife, Lisa, how that happened, and then we can move on to
everybody it was at a flower show, but it wasn't, obviously. It was sailing, and it was on Longobarda. So I probably should blame Mike Slade for that.
So how long was it before you met and you got married? Was this a whirlwind romance or
how long? No, a couple of years, 2 or 3 years, I guess. I can't remember exactly, but yes. So yes, met when I again Chris Law was involved in that Longobarda. So at that stage, there were a lot of regattas going on that you could kind of chop and change. So 1 week I'd be doing a match racing event with Chris Law. The next week I might be doing a maxi event in Sardinia. And, you know, the 2 months before that, I could be doing the Admiral's Cup. So it was basically the calendar was packed. You didn't have any downtime. It was you'd be giving up events to try and mix one with another. There was a huge amount of events going on. You know, at the same start time, the 50-foot circuit started. I was doing that. Yeah, there was an awful lot of events you could be part of them.
There weren't a lot of women running around that world in that point, I wouldn't imagine, as sailors.
Never enough, as we'd all say. No, there weren't a great deal. More in the keelboat scene, probably. because until the girls had positions in the Olympic classes, there were very few. Yeah, very few.
So you guys got married and went on to famously be skippers in the which race was it? The 2001.
That's
two
right.
Race.
Yeah.
Lisa was in charge of Amer Sports too, and you were on, I'm going to say, Asa Abloy.
Asa Abloy. That's right, yeah. Mm.
So that, I'm sure a lot was made of it at the time, but that is an unusual scenario. Did it put extra pressure on both of you, just knowing that you've also got your partner out there?
I think it did to some stage. I mean, we made a pretty clear rule that we never communicated on the water, because I think that could have been misconstrued as some sort of outside assistance. So I don't think we ever sent an email or talked during a leg. And I think that's probably the right thing to do. That could have caused a strain that we didn't need. But I guess because the girls were new to it at that stage, and you know, really, just taking part was a massive challenge to them. The chance of them actually winning the event were less than the rest of the teams. I suspect that took some pressure off. If we were both gunning for the top spots, I don't know, that would have perhaps put a different bent on it.
I also just wonder, you know, when you're in the middle of a heinous storm or something, you know, you can deal with yourself being there, but was there often a time when you're thinking, God, I wonder how Lisa's coping as well with this, you know? And same for her.
Yeah. I mean, because we didn't communicate, I didn't know a lot about it. They had those girls were tough. They had some pretty hard moments. They lost a rig in some very, very unpleasant conditions. And actually listening to her stories afterwards about being towed in, I think it was Nova Scotia somewhere, they were pretty, pretty unpleasant moments. And they toughed it out. And I think if I'd known at the time, it would have taken some energy, and that's one of the reasons. The other reason we didn't communicate, you know, they left Cape Town and their stove broke on the first night. To do a whole Southern Ocean leg without hot food, which meant that you couldn't eat the freeze dried or have a hot drink, just a nightmare. I think I would have turned back. Most sensible people would, but they toughed it out. So it was a very hard race for them, and there were some tough, tough girls on that boat. And I think if I had known some of the moments they were struggling, it wouldn't have helped my focus. But equally, you know, what could I have done? So there was perhaps some sense in not knowing. Not an easy race for those girls at all. And, you know, I think anybody who looks at the glamorous side of sailing thinks that that those races were easy. It would have been difficult for anybody, but for those girls, really very hard work. Very hard work.
Now you kind of inherited the skipper role on that race from Roy Heiner, who I guess we could just say he was fired after the first leg. I think that must have been a slightly difficult position for you to be in. Can you remember that?
I can remember it unbelievably well. And yes, it was a very, very odd position. I had a great deal of support from the people in the team, but, you know, I had a phone call halfway through the first stopover. Oh, we fired Roy. And I was flabbergasted. I said, oh, right. Okay. Why are you talking to me? And then it became clear that I was a stand-in skipper. And until we got, they got something else sorted. And of course, it's like a week to go. And suddenly, not only were we down a very capable skipper, but obviously one of our better helmsmen. So, you know, it was actually a massive challenge to get everything going. So I remember mixed views and feelings at the time. There was certainly no jumping up and down with joy. It was a confusing time for me. And I don't think we did very well on the next leg. In fact, I'm sure we didn't. Not for reasons of the Southern Ocean sailing. It was near the end of the leg, Sydney. I think we messed up, or I messed up. But yeah, it was a confusing time, but obviously a challenge that there was no way I could have run away from, and just took it on. But we were surrounded by some great people in that campaign, and Richard and Johan obviously pushed me into that role and thought I could cope. they might have had reservations halfway through the next leg, but sort of stuck by me and kept me going for the rest of the race. So it was a great opportunity for me, but not one I would have relished in the circumstances that it occurred in.
It worked out pretty well in the end, though, didn't it? Three
leg wins. We were a comfortable second, if I remember right. I don't think we were ever going to challenge for first place, but a comfortable second. And, it was an enjoyable race, a tough, enjoyable race.
And then did you end up on the kind of flip side of that with Ericsson in the following race?
Yes. That was all less enjoyable in many ways, but it was, I think that's obviously where that role came up from.
Okay. Now, we've talked about plenty, I think, about ocean races, Whitbread races, Volvo ocean races. We can skim through a couple of the other ones with Green Dragon, which, I think was an underfunded campaign, but I remember interviewing Ian Walker there as a rookie skipper, and he said, "I've got my guys, I've got my generals." He had you and Damien Foxhall as watch leaders, and that's what it's about, isn't it? It's about having the experience in the right places when you're a rookie skipper.
Yes. No, we had a good team, and I look back at that campaign, and it was never perfect. None of them are, apart from the guy who wins, I guess. But it was good fun. I think we made the best of an opportunity that wasn't perfect. The whole thing was, a little late, a little underfunded. There were some tricky sides to it, but no, it was good fun.
And then if we move on to the Telefonica campaign, sailing with Iker Martinez, I remember you telling me, I was working for the race at that point, and you told me that, Iker was one of the most naturally gifted helmsman sailors that you'd ever sailed with.
Certainly is.
But I think it's fair to say also, a pretty unpredictable character. And towards the end of that race, the team had dominated the early part, and towards the end started to have problems and went downhill pretty quickly and ended up not even on the podium. What did you learn from that whole experience? Because I thought you guys were a cert to win that race.
Well, again, it was another race that we started with lots of preparation, great, strong team, good people, well-funded. I really enjoy working with Pedro Campos. He puts people in a great spot. I think it would be fair to say that I think in the last 10 races, he's put teams on that race. Without him, they probably wouldn't be up. This round the world race would have crumbled a long, long time ago. But he's great at getting campaigns together, and he picked these two wonderful people, Iker and Shabby, and gave them an opportunity to put a good project together. I started that race thinking we should have won. And retrospectively, there's lots of things that would have made a difference. Not breaking two rudders in one leg would have certainly made a big difference. And we started right. We sailed hard. I mean, one thing that Iker and Shabby always do is they push people and boats and equipment to the absolute limit. And we just didn't quite gel. I think actually we weren't on a particularly fast boat. It was very fast in some conditions, not so good downwind. And as the race went on, that Achilles heel kind of opened up. A weakness. Groupama were better, but I still think if we hadn't broken both rudders, we would have come a pretty safe second, which I would have been happy with, to be honest. It was another one of those races that just wasn't meant to be.
From that, I'm thinking that was your last race actively as a sailor. I think you've done a couple of legs as stand-ins, but you moved over into this kind of coaching sailing team manager role with Ian Walker with Abu Dhabi, the campaign that we worked together on, and we happily ended up winning that race, which was fantastic. And then a similar kind of role with Matt Frey in the previous race. And now with Alex Thompson, you're also in that shoreside role. Is that something that you really relish? You really enjoy in that side of things?
I enjoy it because I get to work with great people in the sport that I love. But clearly, if I was able and fit, I'd rather be doing the sailing. But I know my days of pulling ropes and winding winches are long gone at that level. But I know it's a great way to be able to kind of draw on my experiences and work with these wonderful people in these great projects.
Yeah, and I think you're in a remarkable position to be able to witness these great teams. And as you said, none of these teams are perfect. There are always little cracks that appear over the length of a race, like the Ocean Race, the Whitbread, the Volvo. But you should really write the book about how these things play out, right? Because you've got the ringside seat.
Yeah, I do think I'm fortunate enough to have seen, I often tell these guys that I might not be able to tell them how to win, but I can sure tell them how I've lost plenty of races. And I do feel sailing is one of these sports that we unfortunately make the same mistakes again and again and again and again and again. And sometimes it takes enough people who've made these mistakes to say, hold on, no, we've been here before. Let's just hold fire. Let's think about this before we dive down this road. And it clearly is one of the few sports where everybody makes mistakes. You know, you watch a pole vaulter or a hurdler, and the guy who wins basically made no mistakes. But I do think if you win a round the world race, you still made many, many mistakes, just perhaps less expensive ones than the guy who came second. So it is a sport where the complexities of it and the range of talents and things people need is so big. We do make mistakes. And so isolating the ones that are most expensive and trying to avoid those, the pitfalls that we all fall into, minimize those is a key part of it. And perhaps having made many of those, perhaps, you know, I'm in a reasonable position to at least try and stop those happening. I don't always stop them happening, but sometimes I kick myself because I've seen them coming and haven't shouted out loud enough. But I think I'm in a reasonably good position to at least catch some of them before they get too far down the road.
That experience must have been something highly valued by Alex Thompson with his Vendée Globe campaigns. I think it's two campaigns now you've worked on with Alex. Tell us about your role in that setup.
Oh, it's a dream role. Again, I've just been lucky to be involved with the class just when it's got to its most exciting. You know, this foiling or semi-displacement foiling mode that the boats are in is entertaining. It's great fun to be a part of physically, but also academically, it's great to be involved with. So I'm in a dream. Been in a dream position there with Alex, and you know, we get on well. We've done lots of sailing together. In fact, more sailing with him in the last 5 years than with anybody else, and quite a lot of it with him on his own, which I've thoroughly enjoyed. It's a good setup. I've been involved with him off and on now, yes, for, as you say, two campaigns, which are the best part of 5 years, I think. Great entertainment, good fun.
And the role itself is a technical role or a...
Primarily a technical role, but equally, I think the class has gone through so many transitions. This last one to the foiling has presented other problems, other challenges, which have meant that it's good to have a kind of different viewpoint and not being just Imoca background has, I think, been useful and certainly been interesting for Alex to be part of. I've thoroughly enjoyed that part of my sailing career, and it's been the disappointment in this race was huge, but even that aside, it's something I would never want to have missed.
The boat that he had for the last race was just a truly remarkable piece of kit. I mean, the sailing from inside, the level of technology, it looked like the flight deck of a 747 rather than a sailboat. Is that just, you know, how involved in all of that were you? I mean, were you at times thinking?
I can't take credit for much of that at all. The whole design process was done when I was actually still doing the Volvo with Shabby. And I have to say, when Alex first unveiled it, because it was all top secret, not long after the Volvo finished, I looked at it and I thought, blimey, you've gone one too far here, mate. I can see where you're going, but it is the right way for single-handed offshore sailing. It's not something I would choose if I were crude sailing, but for single-handed offshore sailing, I'm quite convinced it won't be long until most people go down that route, to lesser degree or not, but it will be the way that those boats have to end up.
I think a lot of us were worried that the boat might be too technical, that it might suffer some sort of outage, power outage that just puts it out of contention. In the end, it was a good old-fashioned underwater collision with the rudder that put him out. He really did an amazing job of communicating with his audience his original set of problems with the delamination. It was a really cruel blow, wasn't it, when that collision put
it
out?
It is. But you know, you've got to look at the statistics of these things. When we first went around the world, whenever it was, 30 years ago, we had a rudder and a keel in line with each other. You know, you couldn't hit anything on the rudder. It's impossible. You know, physically, unless you had a shark swim between the keel and the rudder and just stop just before you hit the rudder, I mean, the odds are very, very slim. Now we've got these boats with twin rudders, the odds of hitting something on the rudder are pretty high. And it's, to be honest, it's amazing we don't hit more. You know, we have a lot of damage from small impacts, but very few rudders get broken. So, yeah, that was a cruel end. And I do think that, you know, it's a statistics game. And now when we've got these boats with foils, their plan area, the frontal area that can connect with an object in the water is way, way bigger than it used to be. And if you just do it on a statistical basis, then actually it should be at least three times as likely to hit something than you were with a monohull with a single inline rudder and keel. So, yeah, these things do happen. And I have to say, I very rarely talk to Alex during the race for the same reasons I didn't want to talk to Lisa, as I mentioned earlier. I don't want any feeling that there's any collusion or input from me. But once he had retired, I did talk to Alex, and undoubtedly, you know, he was in a very, very low place. But literally, as I was talking to him, I was watching the AIS of Kevin getting out of his boat. And, you know, I said to him, I remember saying, Alex, it's not the end of the world. Think of what Kevin's going through right now. You know, it's a boat race. Boats break, you know, things happen. And it was a cruel, cruel blow. And for Alex, you know, I still think, and I might be biased, but I did spend a lot of time looking at the race afterwards. I still think Alex would have run that race by a long shot if he hadn't broken anything. It's a cruel, cruel blow, not just for Alex, but for the whole team. But we have to put this in reality. It's a boat race. You know, it's not the end of the world.
Not your decision to make, but would you expect to see Alex back for another crack at it?
I've got no doubt he'll be involved in one form or other. I haven't talked to him directly about it. I think it's in his blood. Being that race is him, you know, it really is. So he's bound to be involved in one format or other. That would be my guess.
And tell me, these boats, we're going to see foiling boats in the Volvo Ocean Race. In the Ocean Race.
You're doing just it too.
I've done so well up until now. You alluded to the fact that you wouldn't want to see this enclosed cockpit for crude racing. What do you think of the idea of these boats being a good crude boat? Is it possible?
I think it's a compromise, and you know, if it's a compromise that makes the race happen, then that's worth the effort and the loss of optimized situation. I think whenever it was 12 years ago, I would have probably been a bit anti the one design boat. But, you know, we've had two great races out of it. I've had two jobs out of it. You know, I was wrong to criticize that. I don't think we'd have had another race without it. So if for the same reason we get a race that we wouldn't have had otherwise, then the means justify the end. But they're not an optimal boat for this, I don't think. And I do think I'm in a reasonable position to sit there and say that with a degree of confidence. They are wonderful boats. It will still be an amazing, amazing race, but it's not what you choose to do for a crew boat.
Will we expect to see Neil McDonald involved in the next ocean race?
I hope so, one way or another. But, I mean, it's all looking pretty thin on the ground at the moment. I'd love to be.
Now, Neil, one of the things I've been doing with people, I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit, is asking them about their big day out over their sailing career, big day out on the water. It can be anything, but it's that one thing that you're going to take, you're going to remember until you die. You're going to take it to your grave. You're going to tell your kids' kids about when you're too old to go sailing. Do you have one of those?
I probably do. And it's my first night in the Southern Ocean in Silkcut. I'd left Cape Town. I'd bought a woolen set of gloves because somebody said it might be cold. I could have worked that out myself, perhaps. And I remember a torch going on and the steam coming out of my wet gloves, because I obviously weren't doing any good driving for the first evening in the Southern Ocean. And I did a bit of a whoopsie. I still don't quite know what happened, but the long and short it was, the boat did a massive nosedive, rolled to windward. And we'd been tying all the stacks. It's the first race where you're allowed stacks on deck. We'd been tying all the stacks down to stop them falling into the boat. But what we hadn't worked out at that stage was to stop them being pushed out. So somehow with a nosedive, boat bow goes in, boat rolls up white, wave comes over the boat and knocks the stack over the weather side and takes all the stanchions with it, all of them, like every single stanchion. Now we've got all the sails for the rest of the race in my first Volvo Ocean race, all the sails dangling over the sides, doing 25 knots, me driving, and pretty nervous 25 minutes, thinking, well, I'm going to lose all the sails, which would then render your race useless. But secondly, then everybody coming up on deck with their underwear on, basically from down below, to try and drag these sails back on deck. And in this odd dilemma, obviously to slow the boat down, you bring the boat upright. You bring the boat upright, the sails drag in the water. So I'm on that knife edge, pitch black, as it always is when these things go wrong. First night in the Southern Ocean thing, Chivas. This is going to be a long race.
Oh, wow. You got them back on though, right?
Got them all back on, yeah, and sailed the rest of that leg with no stanchions. Wow. Pretty unpleasant leg.
And any comments from the crew? Any frosty moments?
I do remember Laurie coming on deck and I said, do you want to take it? And he said, no, you take it. And I was thinking, I'm really hoping you'd say you take it, but no. And I've never asked him about it. But yeah, he came on deck, so no, you keep it. And no, please.
That's a truly great big night out for sure. So thank you for that. That will go down on the list. So Neil, I think I've taken up enough of your time. It's nearly an hour and 22 minutes of talking we've done. I've thoroughly enjoyed it, as I knew I would. So thank you for that. And we'll look forward to hearing in the near future, hopefully, what the next project is.
Yeah.
So please keep in touch. Available for hire. Absolutely.
All right, mate.
All right. Until next time, let's speak again. Cheers, Neil.
See you, mate.
Well, that's it for this episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast Extra. My thanks to Neil McDonald for taking time out of his day to speak to me, and to all of you for subscribing and listening around the world. I'll be back soon with another exclusive member-only episode. Until then, I'll just say bye for now.